So the precepts, we have our traditional 16 bodhisattva precepts on page 62 of the liturgy book. We read them every so often. And if you're interested in taking the precepts class in order to take Jukai, formally become a student of Zen, so a Roksu, etc., those will be the ones that will be explicitly in that service. I've also added in our fourfold commitment to racial and social justice, our ecosattva vows, and our GBCC ethics policy, because those are all about our ethics as well. And I like to think of the precepts not so much as a set of rules and not as a series of prescriptions for how to get to enlightenment, but as a really descriptive of the way enlightened people live. And sometimes we get in sync with that and sometimes we don't, but the precepts and our Sangha are around to remind us of how it is that enlightened people do live. Which takes a lot of being on our toes. So originally, the precepts were not part of the Buddha's original teaching, but as he gathered disciples around and had a growing community of monks, later also a community of nuns, they actually had to live together and get along together because people did home leaving, literally left their homes and went and followed Buddha. So the precepts started as some rules for how to live in harmony with each other. And they grew and they grew. The monks at one point ended up with 227 precepts they were supposed to follow. I assume this got down to, don't clip your toenails in the Zendo. And, there's must have been a lot of things that came up that they realized they needed to add a rule for. And the nuns had even more. They had 331 because they, in addition to all the usual stuff, they were supposed to also be showing deference to the monks. All the time. So they had even more rules they were supposed to follow. We fortunately only do the 16 traditional ones and some of these current issues talking about. Now the classic way and useful way of talking about the precepts is to talk about them having three levels. The literal, the compassionate, and the essential. Robert Aiken talks about this. Most discussions of the precepts, you'll hear some talk about this. Aiken also calls them the Hinayana, Mahayana, and Buddha nature levels. But one of the classic stories for telling the difference between the literal and compassionate level is a story of a monk sitting out in the woods. And imagine this monk is part of a community that takes do not kill to mean do not kill animals. A lot of the early communities were strict vegetarian. But the precepts also included don't lie. This monk is sitting out in the woods and a deer goes by going that way. And then shortly after the deer goes by, a hunter comes up and says, which way did the deer go? And the monk says, that way. He literally broke the precept about not lying, but at the compassionate level, sometimes you have to do that. And so he did not take both of these literally and worked it out at the next level. Another way of describing this is, to think of the literal level as the rules. This is good. This is bad. Do this. Don't do that. Just follow the rules. The compassionate level is more relative and contextual. What is the actual situation here? What can be done here to best serve well-being, best serve Buddha. And that might involve not being so literal. And then there's the essential level, and the essential level we refer to in some of our two sutras where we talk about no right, no wrong, don't keep judging good and bad is one of our lines in our sutra book. Don't be a person of right and wrong. Which are, admonitions to stop our constant, evaluating of ourselves and everybody else. But if we take that as the essence of the universe, there is actually just the universe that keeps arising. And in this essential way, there is no right and wrong. However, a warning that that essential level is often used as an excuse to get away with murder at the other levels. A classic problem in Zen groups is for someone to say, well, you know, because my understanding is so vast and essential, therefore I can drink and, you know, sleep with some whoever I want to and whatever. So the essential level is true, and we will see it in our sutra book, and it is not meant to be taken as an excuse to not notice right and wrong and what serves and what doesn't serve in our lives. So we've got a lot of threes today, the three levels, literal, compassionate, essential. The first six of the 16 bodhisattva precepts, the first one, we recite every sutra service, the three refuges. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Sangha, I take refuge in Dharma. And we can actually interpret those using that three-way level tool I just talked about. What do we mean by Buddha? I take refuge in the Buddha. Well, in a literal sense, that's Shakyamuni, right? Shakyamuni is the Buddha, and that's who we think of first when we hear that term. Compassionate level, it's Buddhas at work in the world. Buddhas that we meet on the street. Buddhas that we aspire to embody in our dealings, in our lives. So the compassionate level, when we take refuge in Buddha, we're taking refuge in everything in the world. And the essential nature, we talk about Buddha nature, we talk about the essential awakened nature of all beings. So that is also Buddha, the level of the essential nature from which everything comes. Dharma, we take refuge in the Dharma. Literally, Dharma is often to taken to mean the teachings, meaning the sutras, meaning the books, the stuff written down, the talks the teachers give, you know, the sort of formal stylized, here's the teaching. That's the Dharma. That's the literal level. People may interpret this different ways. I think of the compassionate level there as actually the whole universe is trying to teach us all the time. The myriad things, the 10,000 blades of grass, these are all compassionately reaching out to us at all times, saying, we're here. You know, drop thinking about yourself long enough to notice us. Drop thinking that you're separate from me long enough to really see me, to really hear me. And the 10,000 things are always jumping in front of us. They're always the Dharma. So we read in our stories about people being taught by a sound, by a plum tree, by all sorts of things. And then the essential level of the Dharma. I think in our book, we actually say the ocean of wisdom and compassion. So again, as we talk about Buddha nature, we also talk about the Dharma as this vast truth that is the source of all things. And then lastly, we have Sangha. I take refuge in the Sangha. Certainly our Tuesday and our Saturday and our bright sea and our mustard seed and our Ben are the first things we think about in Sangha, and we do take refuge. We do really need the people in our local communities that we practice with. In a larger, compassionate sense, our Sangha is larger communities, other beings that we interact with. And essentially, it's the interdependent universe and whatever exists that might not be the universe. You know, it is all things that we are totally a part of, never separated from. So the harmony of everything. You folks are being really quiet. Any comments or questions yet before I go on to yet another set of three? Zen seems to be full of these. Okay, so our next set of three, if you have the liturgy book, this is page 62, we're going through the first six in one fell swoop and then taking much more time with the 10 great precepts. The short version of the three precepts is I vow to cease from evil, I vow to practice good, I vow to save all beings. The liturgy book has some extra lines put in there. And the cease from evil, we have a, you know, not knowing, thereby giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe, I vow to cease from evil. So this is sort of the negative side of the precepts, the side of the precepts that say, stop, don't do that. That is prohibited. You might think about it, you might try to justify it, just no, do not. And we think of evil not so much as a thing in itself or beings that by their nature are evil, so much as evil acts. And it's often really much easier to identify evil acts in other people. but our own seeds of greed, anger, and ignorance, our own seeds of attachment, aversion, and delusive certainty are the seeds of evil acts in ourselves and others. Practice good is maybe more of a compassionate level. Instead of just saying, don't do things, it's saying, what can you actually do? What can you actually do that is good? How do we live positively in the world with compassion? So for example, traditionally, one of the precepts was stated as abstain from false speech. And you'll see that in a number of the books. So that's the prohibition level, the stop sign, fairly literal level. Diane Rossetto, in the main book that I've chosen for this series, rephrases it as, I take up the way of speaking truthfully. So she takes it from this positive side, speaking truthfully, a way that's not going to cause harm and is going to cause good. So we see it that way, from that angle, it's not so much a stop sign as a vow or an aspiration. I'm going to really try to actually positively do this, not just desist from that. And the last line, which we have as I vow to save all beings, actually has an interesting historical past that Robert Aiken gets into. In earlier versions of Buddhism, the last line was, I vow to keep my mind pure. I vow to be, you know, become totally free of delusive thoughts. And this was, you know, what was thought of as the Hinayana ideal or the Arhat ideal of personally getting to nirvana. No matter how many lifetimes it takes, I'm going to refine and refine and refine and purify and purify and purify. And then eventually I'll make that stage where I'm entirely free from birth and death and enter nirvana. The Mahayana tradition that we come from doesn't take that as the ideal. It takes the Bodhisattva as the ideal. The Bodhisattva is the entity, person, us, that vows to not enter nirvana until all beings are saved. We're not going to just do this for ourselves. We're doing it in order to bring all beings along. If you try to take that at a literal level, you'll go nuts, right? You know, how in the world do I, as this one individual person, go out there and save all beings? And similarly, even at the compassionate level, I mean, there's only so much time and energy each of us have. And yet, if we don't recognize a division between self and other, there's not that much of a difference between saving myself and saving all beings. So we are acting at an essential level here, as we vow to save all beings, going beyond just compassion to the people we see, into something that's more more radical, more about who we really are in this universe. So that one can only happen with no fixed idea of self and this real realization of this totally interdependent vast universe and vast emptiness. That's the traditional three levels, traditional first six precepts in groups of three. And for this series, I want to add one more group of three on top of that. And then it looks like we will have some time for some questions and discussion about things. And that is, I want to talk about, or I want us to discuss and address the precepts at three sorts of levels of differently configured levels of practice, and that is individual, community, and world, or worlds. I chose the Rosetto book because it gives us a method for working with the precepts that I haven't seen in any other precepts book. And you can study about the precepts forever. And it's helpful. It's helpful to read books that talk about their history and that talk about them. What I like about the Rosetto book is it opens up, we'll talk next week about the process that she suggests, which doesn't start out with learning the precept and then saying, okay, now I'm going to go do it. I vow to speak truthfully. It doesn't say, okay, I'm going to go out there and every time I feel like I'm going to lie, I'm going to stop. Actually, she doesn't start there. She doesn't start with changing behavior. She starts with just noticing behavior, waking up to what you do, waking up to what we do. So our first step is not to try to change. It's easy if we just try to change to do something that's just kind of surface, and also to get very discouraged very quickly because we find that habitually we keep on doing the same thing. So our first step is just going to be to break that habit. And so she goes through this, and I think it's a very helpful process rather than just here are the rules, go out and do them. She expresses them all at a very personal level, a very individual level of who we meet each day, who we meet in our family, who we meet in our workplace, who we meet on Zoom, as the case may be, our financial obligations and daily life. So really a lot about the individual in our daily life and how we go about facing these precepts in that context. The Aiken book, which doesn't have so much of a method in it, although I do recommend one chapter, the book is called Mind of Clover, and he's a book called Mind of Clover, which gets a little bit into sort of the feeling of working with the precepts. It's one of the later chapters in the book. He doesn't put it up front. But Aiken talks a lot more about the community and world level, which is important. Important to me personally, important to our line of Zen here in the U.S., that this is not, Zen is not just about navel gazing and being complacent about all of the suffering going on around us. It also requires us to take notice of things, not only waking up to we do, but waking up to what's going on around us and responding to that as well. So in fact, the original precepts started out about how to live together in a sangha. So they were really community oriented to begin with, how to not murder each other when you're living together 24 hours a day in a garden somewhere, right? So they started out being about community. Aiken actually has a chapter in his book about samu, about work practice within a sangha. So there are, and we're going to be talking about this GBCC ethics policy at one point. We have a Sangha community in which ethics have come to the fore in recent months. And the ethics policy was long delayed, but it finally came out this last month. So we're going to spend some time talking about the ethics of living and working together in a Sangha. But our community, we also can unintentionally, perhaps, but still do quite a lot of evil by staying too closely within our comfortable group. Our comfortable group in our sangha, our comfortable group in our neighborhood. And so remaining ignorant about the harm we do at larger perspectives. So Aiken, you'll find the book is a bit dated. He wrote during the Vietnam War years. So he has got more things in there about war and nuclear threat and other things. If he was writing today, he'd probably, not the nuclear threat has gone anywhere or that war is gone anywhere. He'd also be talking more about climate change and, a lot of other things going on. So we're also going to talk about how our Zen practice and precepts meet the road at that level. And we can take it up even another level, not just about human beings in our community and our larger human community, but what about other sentient beings? What about non-sentient beings? They sometimes come into our sutra books. So we're going to talk about some of the eco-sattva practices. How do we care for our world as well as for humans. That gets into the whole question of, where do we fit in this vast universe? So we're back to our essential level as we talk about how our precepts cover all of this. Good. I left about 18 minutes in the allotted time. I want to, two kinds of things here. One is questions about the class, about the readings, about the precepts in general, comments about things. Also, if you might want to reflect on, if there's certain parts of the precepts you feel drawn to, and other parts that you may avoid a little bit more. It's a good thing to kind of think about and ponder. But now I'm going to shut up, and I will call on anybody who wants to share a question or a comment or a reason for coming or questions about the Jukai ceremony or, anything related to what we're doing here. So I've now explained life, the universe, and everything so well, you have no questions left. Got to be something. Lynn.
I'm trying to make a question out of a confused thought that I'm having. When we're working together on this and thinking about the community and the world, I'm feeling concerned about my own inability to go back to the world right now. And I know that it is typical and healthy for each of us to handle this post-pandemic reentry and the choices that we make in the ways that work for each one of us. But I'm just feeling concerned that I want to learn about the precepts with the community in mind, and yet I don't really feel ready to be part of the wider world at this point either. So I'm feeling a little bit torn about that, and I'm wondering if other people are feeling that or have any insights about that.
I mean, just personally, I'm feeling it. It's a new world. It's not the same world we left. 16, 17 months ago, whatever it was. It's a different world, and it makes me, and I'm an introvert. I would just as soon, stay home all the time. Not quite, but when I went on public transportation for the first time since before the pandemic, just yesterday. So it's getting back into things. I hadn't really thought about it in the context of the precepts, but that's an interesting thing to think about, because I have probably gotten a lot more sort of, I mean, in some ways, I've been more community involved through the upset in the Sangha and all of the time I've spent on Zoom meetings and drafting documents. And, there are some things I've been more involved in. But there's certainly lots of things I've been less involved in. Interesting thing to raise, Lynn, for maybe us all to ponder as we enter yet another new world. Thank you. Jeannie.
Hi. So I opened up my email this morning and I saw that you were studying this group tonight. And I've always wanted to read that book. And I struggle reading a lot of Zen literature on my own. I really appreciate reading it and talking about it with other people interested in Zen. So I bought it and I signed up and I put you on my calendar. I've done the precepts and I done Jukai, and I just wanted to make sure, is it okay that I'm here?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I'm looking forward to doing this series, and I'll probably repeat it again and again because we need to come back to the precepts. And again. Exactly. You may be preparing to take the precepts. You may never take the precepts. You may have already taken the precepts. Doesn't make a difference. This is a worthwhile study and conversation at any point.
I was looking for some validation. Thank you.
Yeah, great. No, very welcome. Deanne, Dion.
I usually practice the Tibetan Chinrezig style of Buddhism, and I love this Mahayana style as well. My question is, how does the Dhammapada fit into the Mahayana side of things, and do I need to do more in-depth study of that as well before I can learn the precepts, or should I do the precepts first and then go back to the Dhammapada?
You hit a spot of great ignorance here, because I'm not that familiar with Tibetan traditions.
Okay.
So you really have to ask, see if a Tibetan teacher knows enough about Zen to answer that question.
Okay.
I have some impressions that I don't believe Tibetan is in the Mahayana. I think it is more of the, we call it, the Mahayana is the great vehicle, and they made this rather derogatory term, Hinayana, small vehicle, for the Buddhist type of Buddhism that looks for the arhat ideal, the personal purification ideal. My sense is that sort of officially Tibetan Buddhism is a lot more of that. What I do think you see in a variety of teachers and teachings and books is more agreement than you would expect, looking at the historical lineages and the several things. There are some Zen teachers that just kind of stay out in space and, emphasize purity, and then there are, some Tibetan teachers that are much more interested in compassionate action in the world. So,
and I find that being here at GBZC, it has the more compassionate action in the world. So I see that is the overlap. So that's kind of what's drawn me to GBZC. So I was just wondering if that's okay to have that in to learn more about the precepts.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Like I said, you may want to take them in Zen or not. It doesn't, the formal ceremony of Jukai. But, these are all, like I said, they're helpful guides to how an enlightened person lives. Just by the way, let's remind ourselves that, this is a better way and that's not a better way. And, these are not easy to figure out necessarily, right? Which is why we have study and why we have discussion and why we have to really reflect on how to act on these in our life. They're not always simple and they're not always straightforward. Even the deer in the woods story, we've already got a conflict coming up. Yeah. So, thank you. Chris.
I was wondering if you could share a little more about Jukai. I'm a little bit new to Buddhism, and so I just don't know anything about some of these things. So could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
In the Jukai ceremony, it's really considered the sort of a declaration of formally becoming a Zen student, formally becoming a follower of Buddha. It is not an accomplishment of anything. It is, although we do ask that people study the precepts beforehand, either one-on-one in Dokusan with teachers or in a series like this or a little bit of both or a couple classes in a series of time over a series of years, whatever. But you do go through the precepts. And before the Jukai ceremony, you will be asked to come up with a statement or two about how you understand each of them. And it's a really interesting ceremony to attend. I remember the one about not becoming intoxicated. I remember one student's comment was, been there, done that. So anyway, people come up with their own interpretations of what these, what these precepts mean to them. And there's some, it's a ritual. So there's the candles and the bells and some chants and everything else. You're welcome to invite friends and family. The other thing you have to do if you want to formally take the precepts is so a raksu, the little black bib type thing that people wear in the sangha. You get a wooden or bamboo ring, usually from your teacher, if you tell them you want to take Jukai, or a teacher if you don't have a particular teacher. And then the traditional thing is to sew this by hand. It's a representation of a monk's robe. You probably can't see it here, but there's all sorts of little pieces of fabric sometimes called a rice field in the middle here, a bunch of little pieces of fabric sewn together. In Buddha's day, the monks went out to the dump, picked up scraps of fabric, dyed them saffron, I think, and then stitched them together. So a representation of the Buddha's robe is taking little scraps of fabric and sewing them together. It's black. Black means Zen student. I also have the right to wear a gold, and I have one, but I feel funny about it right now until we're clearer in our sangha about what that means. So I'm still wearing my my black. The ring represents the Enzo, a symbol of unity of emptiness and form. The back gets stamped with the name of your group. I got this back in 2007 with Boundless Way Zen, a big Zen seal, the names of your teachers, and you receive a Zen name. My Zen name is Sado, meaning clear way. So it's a piece of white silk in the back. It is possible to buy this if you're really, you know, unable to sew it or to get somebody to sew it for you. Traditionally, people would sew this and like say some kind of vow or something like that, like with every stitch. I can't even remember what that vow is. I did not do that. Harriet in the Cambridge Sangha is leading online Roxu sewing classes once a month on Saturday afternoons. You can buy kits. You could get a kit from Harriet, whatever. But this is, you know, you'll see people wearing these in practice, and that's what they are. They're symbolic. Apparently it got shortened during a time of persecution of Buddhists in China. They couldn't go around wearing full monk's robes because they'd get killed. So they made this little abbreviated version to wear under their other clothing. In the Jukai ceremony, you've sewn this roxu in advance, given it to the teachers. They've done all their stuff on the back, and then it gets handed back to you. And you do this silly thing about putting it on your head before you put it on your body. And if you get a chance to attend, I'll be scheduling one for sometime in January. I'll probably kind of poll people, you know, a number of people, because some people have already taken precepts classes and all that are ready to go, but just haven't done it yet. So any of you that might be interested and have a Roxu ready, and some of them probably a Saturday, can probably make it hybrid, I hope, you know, if we're back in the Zendo by that time. But I'm going to schedule it for January. Josh.
Can you talk briefly about like what it means to be a formal student of a specific teacher, and like how does that differ, if it does at all, from just like every week you're having Dokusan with a specific teacher? Is that different from that, or is that the same, or like what's the deal?
Unmuting. Having a particular teacher is not required for becoming a formal student or taking Jukai. You're kind of on your honor to have studied all the precepts. I mean, the teachers usually kind of talk each other, you know, if a name comes up, somebody asking to do Jukai that they've never heard of, they'll check around or they'll ask you who you've been studying with. So you're not just walking in off the street saying, oh, this sounds cool. But you don't have to have worked with a particular person. You know, if your teacher doesn't have any rings, ask another teacher, because somebody does. And we'll give you one to inspire you to continue and carry through with this and actually use that ring in a roxy. There's a formal way of taking a particular teacher. It's called Shoken, S-H-O-K-E-N. It's described on the website. There's a next step dropdown that has this. If you feel a particular affinity with a particular teacher, you can do this with them. If you're ever going to be sort of on a teacher track, that is becoming, we have this whole thing of assistant teacher, senior assistant teacher, which are both still black Roxu kind of teaching ranks, and then gold Roxu Dharma holder sensei ranks. In order to be what's called a transmitted teacher, Dharma holder or sensei, you have to have a particular sponsoring teacher. So at that point, you do have to have a Shoken teacher. But up until then, it's not particularly necessary. And the advantage of going and seeing different teachers, at least some of the time, is it's a little easier to sort out what's the Dharma and what's that particular teacher's personality. Some sanghas that are gathered around teacher, you find, you know, that people are unconsciously mimicking their teacher's mannerisms and way of speech. And they do, you know, everything, you know, and it's kind of silly, but that's because they've only seen one example of the Dharma, and, you know, you can't necessarily sort out what's the Dharma and what's the teacher. So good to see a variety of people, but if you feel a particularly affinity with one, you can think about doing Shokan. And the Shokan ceremony is quite brief. Most of our teachers will ask you to write a couple page spiritual autobiography, just so they know a little bit more about you. And traditionally you give them some kind of token gift, like a little box of incense. And that's Shokan. So you would talk to someone beforehand and see what they require. But independent track from taking the precepts. You can do one or the other, or neither or both. Rebecca.
Yeah, I really am drawn to this notion of the precepts as supportive rather than just prohibitive. Mm-hmm. And it's already kind of shown up in my life in that way. And I'm just thinking about at the hospital the other day where I work as a chaplain, I was doing a spirituality group on behavioral health, and which is the inpatient psychiatry unit. And so much of my training in those groups has been around redirecting energy or holding a lot of disparate energies. And there was a moment where someone made a racial slur, and I felt like my training was to redirect or not give it attention, when in fact what was called for was a very skillful denouncing of that. And so I felt like I had caused harm in the way that I responded or didn't respond to that in the moment. And so I spent the whole rest of the afternoon thinking about, and still I'm thinking about, just how can the precepts, like, how is causing harm a doorway into learning rather than a wall or a place to get stuck? How can I take this moment of having caused harm and walk through it, learn from it, be supported by the precepts in it? And so I'm just like kind of metabolizing how I am a harm causing being and how to not just get stuck there, but move with it and notice it and hopefully change it.
Well, this is why I find Diane Rosetto's approach so good, because we're never going to not be harm causing, right? I mean, there's always going to be something that we're doing and something more to learn and something more to develop. So the idea we're going to get to purity. Sorry, folks, if you want, you thought you're going to be pure by the end of, you know, 10 weeks here, 12 weeks, it ain't going to happen. But she talks about when we start to note it, when we start to wake up to what we do, we see these big signs that say, enter here. Okay, this is where the next piece I need to work on. This is the next thing I need to ponder. Yeah, we're out of time. If anybody has more questions or want to stay on, you're welcome to. But I'm also conscious of people having busy lives, and always feel free to leave right at 5:45 if you need to. You know, I think we're basically done now, but I'll hang on a couple of minutes in case anybody wants to stay around for something else. Thank you so much for coming and sharing your practice. And in the future, you will be sharing much more discussion. So please do, if you haven't gotten the books yet, start reading in Rosetto. And next week, we will talk about this process, how we get to that enter here sign and work with it. So thanks so much.